The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Partly cloudy skies. Welcome to this Monday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, conversations about this weekend's protests and what's next for the city of Atlanta.
What I know about Atlanta, even though it is the city too busy to hate, I think that's a nice catchphrase, but I don't know if that's the case. And I think if you talk to Black folks here in Atlanta from all walks of life, they would tell you that that's not the case. And some of the things that they have gone through and continue to go through, and, you know, the socioeconomic disparities that exist here and the racial disparities here and the health disparities here, we have to be mindful of making broad statements and characterizing this city as something that it may not have ever been for a large group of people, based on their socioeconomic status for sure, and their racial status as well.
That's coming up in just a moment. But first, the latest information, as always, as it relates to the coronavirus here in Georgia. As of 9 a.m. today, there are 47,496 confirmed COVID-19 cases. The number of deaths statewide is reported to be 2,055. And there are 8,033 hospitalized. Now, that's all according to the Georgia Department of Public Health, again, as of 9 a.m. today. In other related news, Georgia's bars and nightclubs can open starting today. Business owners must follow 39 state-mandated safety guidelines in order to reopen. And those guidelines include measures such as screening employees for COVID-19 and limiting capacity to 25 people or 35% of total occupancy. This is Closer Look.
Yes, it's my city, and I'm deeply sad in what I'm looking at here today. I saw this city take off when I was 18 years old in the 70s, when it began to really grow and prosper to where it is now. This is a major setback for Atlanta right here.
We people who are darker than blue.
And all this can be rebuilt, but it's tarnished.
And let what others say come true. We're just good.
There is something different about this moment.
A boy's grown.
I think a lot of our white brothers and sisters are starting to look in the mirror and ask themselves, like, okay, maybe I am a part of the problem. Maybe my silence is a part of the problem.
Atlanta has always been a strong city. We're different than other cities, you know? From here, exactly what you see today, we're already rebuilding our city. We're already taking care of each other, you know? Atlanta is a strong city, and I think from here we can just promote change.
You're just the surface of our dark, deep well. If your mind could really see, you know your color the same as me.
For decades, longer than I've been alive, we've seen people unjustly killed, unjustly jailed or oppressed, and it's finally come to a head.
So the conversations that I had with my son late last night while we were watching this, and he was like, Dad, why are they destroying my city? And I paused for a moment and I said, son, people are angry, people are hurt, and they are acting out, but that's not the way to do it. Like, how do we do it? And I paused and he was like, is it love? And my son is 6 years old. He talked about love.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Voices from folks I spoke with this past Saturday afternoon, the day after what is now a historic turn of events for the city of Atlanta. This week on Closer Look, our conversations will solely be dedicated to this weekend's protests, the aftermath, and what's next, Atlanta. And conversations about turning initial outrage to actionable outcomes. We'll talk about 21st century protesting. Where's Atlanta's next wave of young leadership coming from? We'll talk about voting and race reconciliation. But we'll begin with Ilya Davis, Director of New Students and Transition Programs and a Professor of Philosophy from Morehouse College. Also from Georgia State University, Associate Professor in African American Studies and the author of The Legend of the Black Mecca, Politics and Class in the Making of Modern Atlanta, Maurice Hobson. And also in Singer Burton, Professor and Multimedia Journalist, who's also the Co-Director of Film and Media Management at Emory University, and they all are regular contributors to Closer Look. Thank you all for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
for having me.
Professor Burton, I'll start with you. Just your reaction on all of the events that took place this weekend here in Atlanta.
I think it's been really interesting looking at what people have been talking about on social media in terms of the responses and listening to the audio that you played for us at the beginning of the show, at the top of the show. There are a lot of mixed emotions, a lot of different types of feelings. I think a lot of people are disappointed in what has been happening. I think there's been a lot of blame placed on young kids of color, which I don't think is necessarily truthful. Mm-hmm. And honest. And I do believe that there's been some revisionist thinking, especially as it relates to this cradle of civil rights where we live, Atlanta, Georgia, in terms of what people prior to them, prior to this movement and this moment, had to go through in order to get the change that was needed here. So, you know, it's been difficult to watch the destruction of buildings, but I think what's been more difficult to watch is the destruction of Black bodies on videotape. And I think that people need to remember how we got here. You know, it's horrible that we are here and this is what it's turned into. But we people need to remember how we got here. And, you know, sometimes nonviolence doesn't work. Sometimes turning the other cheek doesn't work. Sometimes passive measures do not work. And when people are frustrated and don't have strategies and ways and tools for channeling that frustration, it often looks like this during uprisings. And these are uprisings. These are not riots as it relates to Black people. As it relates to Black people. I don't know what some of these anarchists and stuff are doing, but for the Black folks, it's an uprising.
Professor Davis, your thoughts on this weekend's events?
Well, I've had difficulty just imagining what emotion I would allow to come forth. One of the most difficult things I've had to manage is I'm not so much angry as I am psychologically lethargic. I mean, it happens so frequently and the profundity of it is so overwhelming. I hate to say that I've gotten close to saying again, 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 and I try not to allow it to be normalized for myself, because that level of, like, again, lethargy just should not settle in on one, because it overwhelms you when it comes to a head, when you watch videos. I did a little march with a group yesterday. It erupts, and sometimes I can understand how it erupts in destructive forms. And so for me, it's been very difficult trying to manage what I would think. And the problem has often been not conscious thoughts, but the unconscious wavering from anger to I'm decidedly against certain behaviors. How do you evaluate them? As the professor just said, how do you give an account of the pain and hurt that seems to somehow manifest itself in the destruction of private property? And I can understand how that happens. The difficulty, again, though, is how do you think about it? How do you wrap your mind around it such that you then include your own existential experiences, your children, your friends, your family? I'm from Atlanta. And so I guess I don't have the same familial attachment to the physical and material structures of Atlanta as I do to my communities. I grew up in an environment that was very communally based, the Stewart Avenue, Pittsburgh area. So I guess I have an affinity for that in ways that buildings and other material things that are insured, I think, the fundamental issues have been undermined by people trying to focus on the destruction of private property. And so all this is going through my mind as I observe, and I'm saying to myself, how do you evaluate the pain and suffering and the trauma of a people such that when you give an account of it, it's reduced to the things and the material things of the world? And I think that's going to be a fundamental problem for us, because we have landed, at least at this point, in the morass that we have, primarily because we have had a materialistic, and I don't pause to say capitalistic, market-driven notions of what's more important here. Mm-hmm. And it seems that people are emphasizing the material over mm-hmm. the human.
Mm-hmm. Professor mm-hmm. Hobson.
This is a great question. And much like my colleagues here articulated, you have this anger, you have this psychological draining in the midst of a pandemic.
Yes.
And that's what's different for myself. Right now in the state of Georgia, we've not had adequate testing with COVID-19. The state of Georgia has not done what it needs to do. The federal government has been extremely negligent on what needs to happen. And then you're still seeing the same pandemic problem of racism that is permeating. And I've been sitting here and wondering, what effects will this have on my body? But what is this doing to our young people? Mm-hmm. And, whether you have children or not, if you have young people in your family, you often think about these situations. Myself, I have a 5-year-old son, and I see a lot of postings on social media that talks about, I'm a parent of a Black boy, but the police are harming and killing Black girls and Black women, in the same manner. And the thing about it is, my son saw we were watching the news and he saw George Floyd, he saw Ahmaud Arbery just in passing, and he began to ask questions, and he adores the police. And now I'm trying to explain, he's a 5-year-old, I'm trying to explain to him that not all policemen are good people and not all of them are bad and all of these different things. But with this being said, one of the things that I do notice is that a lot of people of all walks of life could use a really good history class. And that history class is important because if you know and understand anything about this idea of civil rights, Atlanta is, I would not argue it as the cradle of civil rights. It is one of several campaigns, but it's a different kind of campaign. And, the legislation that comes out of Birmingham and Selma, the terrorism that took place in Jackson, Mississippi, Little Rock, Arkansas, Dallas, Texas, New Orleans, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. These are the areas. And so the fact that Dr. King, peace be upon his soul, came from Atlanta and was able to do aspects of the movement. If Dr. King were alive, he would say that he was not the leader of the movement. And so much of that, as Professor Davis stated, has been market driven. And we must know and understand that there have been tempests and there have been outbreaks in terms of rebellion. And when I use the term rebellion because it represents plantation politics. And a riot is just this kind of outrage that comes to destruct, whereas a rebellion is really an overthrow of a system that has been oppressed.
Professor Hobson, let me stay with you for a moment because of something that you just said, and I anticipate emails and maybe other sure. social media correspondence. You said if Dr. King were alive today, he would say he was not the leader of the movement. And I want to give you an opportunity to dissect that further for someone who might take issue with that.
Yeah, Dr. King was one of thousands of leaders in the movement. And we have to have a real conversation around leadership and organizers. Now, that is not a slight to Dr. King. But if you study Dr. King, you would know who Vernon Johns was, the minister at Dexter Avenue, who was really a grassroots organizer. And not to say that King wasn't. For those, I spent a lot of time studying Atlanta in my career. A lot of what Dr. King took or used on a platform, some of that, and I'm not going to say much of it, came from John Wesley Dobbs. A lot of his speeches, Dr. King would go to John Wesley Dobbs and ask his permission if he could use John Wesley Dobbs' speeches. and they become speeches that are now associated with Dr. King. So what I'm saying is that Dr. King was one aspect of the movement, and he understood that there were other kinds of leaders.
Well, let's get into that. Let's take that further, because Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, along with other notables, it was Bernice King, Killer Mike, and T.I. imploring those who were partaking in the destruction and looting to stop. Let's play a clip of Mayor Bottoms.
I wear this each and every day, and I pray over my children each and every day. So what I see happening on the streets of Atlanta is not Atlanta. This is not a protest. This is not in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. This is chaos.
Professor Burton, I'm going to start with you. This label of Atlanta, the city too busy to hate, which actually came out of the 60s, this peaceful city of protest, does that no longer resonate across generations here in Atlanta?
I think that Atlanta has a lot of transplants here, first of all. So I think a lot of times people in Atlanta talk about Atlanta as if everyone has been here, you know, since and during this time period that we keep referencing. And that's just not true. I think the mayor is attached to Atlanta. Obviously, she's from Atlanta. I think people who are from here, born and raised, have a different perspective and way of being and thinking and seeing Atlanta. And so for her, and I, you know, like Dr. Davis is talking about, you know, it's a different type of response when this is your hometown. This is how you see yourself. This is these are the people who raised you, the communities that raised you. And then you also made it to the mayor's office, right? The mayoral place, which is a position of power. So I don't, I think that what she said was salient and was important. However, I don't agree with this not being Atlanta. I'm an outsider. Let me just say that straight up. So, you know, what I know about Atlanta, even though it is the city too busy to hate, I think that's a nice catchphrase, but I don't know if that's the case. And I think if you talk to Black folks here in Atlanta from all walks of life, they would tell you that that's not the case. And some of the things that they have gone through and continue to go through, and, you know, the socioeconomic disparities that exist here and the racial disparities here and the health disparities here, despite having these world-class medical institutions, whether you talk about Morehouse School of Medicine or Emory, you know, or the CDC even. So I think, again, one of the points I want to make today is that we have to be mindful of making broad statements and characterizing this city as something that it may not have ever been for a large group of people based on their socioeconomic status, for sure, and their racial status as well, and access to power. Cultural capital, too.
Professor Davis, so. I'm going to get to you in a moment, because based on what just Professor Burton just said, I'm going to play a clip with part of a conversation I had with an Atlanta resident, Eva, who moved here 6 years ago. When did you arrive?
I got here probably about 8 or 9.
Through your lens, what happened? Why did it turn from what some say was peaceful?
It was very peaceful, and it went the other way when the police fired tear gas at us. When the police fired tear gas, it was another race that set the police car on fire.
It was white people?
It was white people who set the police car on fire. It was more whites out here than blacks, if believe it or not.
So Professor Davis, here's someone who moved here about 6 years ago. She came to the protest. She said she got there about 8 or 9 o'clock that night. And through her lens, she said this was other people, maybe not Atlantans, who started the chaos. Professor Burton brought up that, look, Atlanta's a city of transplants. So I'll ask you that same question in terms of this moniker that Atlanta's carried for decades, the city too busy to hate, and the Atlanta way, whatever that is, because the Atlanta way can be defined, it's subjective depending on who you ask. So I'll ask you, Professor Davis, is it time that we stay away from that, those two monikers, the city too busy to hate and this cradle of the civil rights movement and the fact that Atlantans don't do this or Atlanta doesn't do that?
Well, I'll say, and I will defer to my brother Hobson on the specifics, but it's interesting the hyperbole people have used since I was a child. And brother Hobson and I have had extensive conversations about this. Where I grew up, the so-called civil rights development or presence here in Atlanta was interpreted differently based on socioeconomic location. My grandfather did not even herald certain people that Atlantans love. I won't mention their names, but we can guesstimate who they were. You know, his response was, I don't talk to those Negroes. I don't like them. Why? Because Atlanta has fundamentally been a classist environment. It's not merely racist, which it has been, but it's also extremely classist.
Within the Black community, you're talking about within the Black community too.
Yeah, you and I had this conversation one of the Martin Luther King holidays. Mm-hmm. People didn't like it, but Atlanta is extremely classist. I mean, there's certain neighborhoods we can begin to articulate or to identify. You know, people will say, that's where this family grew up. And then they'll even go by family names. And no, nobody knows my family name. And I used to have to engage people. Well, who are your people? You don't know my people. Matter of fact, as Brother Hobson knows, my people would not have been some that you wanted to interact with, all right, to euphemize. So the thing has to do more with, we don't want to somehow be so hyperbolic that we lose the historical context, as my brother just referred to. We can include Atlanta in the range of Mississippi's, Alabama's, and so forth. That's fine. But there's something about having to be the best. And I think Atlanta, not unlike Chicagoans and New York, I mean, come on, Brooklyn, USA, as if it were, you know, this independent entity. So I understand the disposition, but the honesty has to come forth. And on the other side, I mean, part of the difficulty of being from Atlanta and having others come in, they have been captured by this false veneer of safety and the Negro making it. So when I left Atlanta for graduate school, people would often say, ooh, I might move to Atlanta. Why? Because Black people know we don't own a brick downtown. So when you start talking about power or access, no, Atlanta is not what you think it is. I love Atlanta, but don't be so overwhelmingly romantic about it that you believe it's going to be the promised land. Now, everybody recalls Hollywood Shuffle in one of the brief scenes, and the guy said, we're going to the promised land. He said, where's that, Cleveland? And now it's flipped the other way. People from the north now, I'm going to Atlanta. Why? Promised land. No. Racism is endemic in this country, and it's to the marrow. So Atlanta cannot escape that. So if I were to say all dogs are canine, there is no exclusion. The United States of America is embedded in racist ideology, fundamentally grounded in a certain profit margin driven racism. And so Atlanta nor Georgia can escape these things such that we would like to romanticize. No, and I love my city, but we have to be more dialectical and understand the complexity of where we are. And so our responsibility is to do our best to improve these conditions. And my last little statement is, just look at, I always tell people, look at south of Five Points versus north of Five Points. There's no reason in the world that Atlanta, my Atlanta, should still at this point underdevelop the south, southwest side past Little Five Points, right? I mean, not Little Five Points, but Five Points. You see a fundamental material difference. And now they're going to create density on the north end of Atlanta when you have all this property that's underdeveloped on the southern sides. That's fundamentally a problem.
Professor Hobson, you're the historian here because you've done a lot of research in the history of Atlanta as it relates to Black folks, the Black Mecca. So given what you all just said, should the expectation then, or was the expectation that Friday's events, Friday's planned protests, would not morph into chaos because of this moniker that has been on Atlanta for so long? And Chief Shields, Erica Shields, Atlanta Police Department, said we were caught off guard. So the expectation was that nothing will erupt like it does in the other cities because we don't do this here in Atlanta. But that was wrong. Whoever we is, that was down there. Professor Hobson?
Yeah, so I think that the statements of my colleagues, they've been spot on. I mean, really spot on, which I don't have to say as much. But to add to Professor Davis's comments, you know, the thing about, I am not from Atlanta. I grew up in the neighboring state of Alabama. I grew up in Selma, Alabama, home of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Bloody Sunday, the whole nine. F.D. Reese was my principal growing up. Joanne Mance, Bob Mance's wife, taught me social studies. I mean, Gene Jackson was my sixth grade history teacher. But I do love this city. Mm-hmm. And I was raised to where you're honest with the things that you love. And the thing about it is all of Atlanta's hubris as the city too busy to hate, as the Black Mecca, as Hotlanta, as you know, all of these different marketing strategies or marketing taglines put so much pressure on the city of Atlanta that it doesn't allow for them to be human. If the city would really sit down and do a real history lesson, and when I say a real history lesson, not a history that appeases to the races and talk about how tolerable a tolerable white business community was tolerable of Black people. I'm talking about just a real conversation. We would know and understand that in 1966, there was a Summer Hill Rebellion where Harold Prather was shot and killed by a policeman in Summer Hill, right next to Georgia State, right next to the Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, and how, you know, things erupted there. Ivan Allen had to kind of really go and they booed and hissed him and threw bottles at him. 1967, the Dixie Hill Rebellion. In 1968, before King was assassinated, President Lyndon B. Johnson commissioned a report that would later be known as the Kerner Report that was to help America understand why Black people were rebelling in cities. Notice I'm saying rebelling, not rioting. And what comes from this, and this is months before Dr. King was assassinated, what happens with this is that it becomes clear that there are two Americas, one white, one Black, and they're going in different directions. And how slavery and the racial tension, the sordid racial history of the United States really undermined the process of Black folk and equality. And how Johnson was interested in preventing this, and then Dr. King's assassinated. It was a sad day. But what Ivan Allen understood better than other mayors is he understood that he had to get to King's family, and he really had to get those folk in the community to really not allow for Atlanta to burn because it was King's hometown. And so this whole idea of the Atlanta way really has more to do, the way in which it's presented on the world stage really has more to do with the reason that Atlanta was the only major Black city not to erupt after Dr. King was assassinated was because they respected their most beloved son. So I don't understand why this was not a thought. What I'm saying is that we have to make sure that our elected officials have good intel and good information.
52 years later, professors, and what we do know is that for many, because they've told us they've had enough as it relates to the deaths of Black people at the hands of law enforcement through their lens. I want to go back to Eva for a moment because here's the other part of our conversation.
So let me ask you this, and I see on your shirt, I can't breathe. Where do we go from here? Where does Atlanta go from here?
I say burn it down. If it was one of my three boys, I would not sit on TV and I would not ask for peace to be held. No, burn it down. They need to hear us and hear us now. They didn't want us to kneel peacefully. You know, they don't want us to come out here and protest peacefully. They don't want us to stand for us peacefully. You know, but it got to start somewhere and they got to hear us and we got to make it be heard.
What's your response to someone that says, oh, burn it down, what good will that do?
Burning it down would do a lot. They would start, their eyes will open. If we affect the white man's money, where it means something to them, you know what I'm saying? I believe that they will wake up, they will start realizing.
Is there any other solution though, besides burning it down and people possibly losing their lives? Is there any other solution?
Start convicting these white men for killing us. The men that hide behind the badges, they're killers, they're murderers, they're human just like we are. They need to stand to the same laws that we have to stand by. I am a Black mother of three Black boys. Burn the city down. I'm with it. I'm tired. Burn it down.
Thank you.
So that was Eva, mother of three Black boys, she told me. I would tell you there were others who felt the same way as Eva. Professor Burton, your reaction to what she had to say?
I think that, you know, Eva reflects the frustration that a lot of Black people have as it relates to our long and ongoing precarious relationship with the police departments throughout, you know, the country, really throughout the world, right? As it relates to Black people. And the frustration of hearing people over and over again really focus on property and material items as opposed to the reasons why folks are out here. Mm-hmm. You know, what she's talking about is, you know, doing something, you know, her response is burn it down because that's the only thing that white people appear to care about, white people who are in power appear to care about, because it affects their bottom line, right? Because, you know, they're not listening to the peaceful protest. That's why I'm just like incredulous over people who are like, we need to go back and protest the way we used to protest. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, they're not listening to peaceful protests. They're not listening to the legislators who are like, stop this stuff. They're not listening to the community activists who are like, stop this stuff. They're not listening to the celebrities who are like, stop this stuff. They're not listening to the academics who've been documenting and writing and documenting and writing and presenting and writing and documenting and presenting and saying, stop this stuff. Something has to be done. They're not listening to people who represent police departments and they're saying, hey, here are some tools that you can use in order to de-escalate. And this is how you work with the community and all of these things. They're not taking advantage of listening to implementing policies that protect people like us, you know, that protect people who look like us, men and women. The Spelman and Morehouse student who were pulled out of the car yesterday, they didn't just pull the black boy out. They pulled the black girl out and pepper sprayed them, maced them, you know, they tased them. But they're not responding to that. So this is what happens when you don't take a proactive look at what you need to do to really impact and change the ways in which police departments, and I extend that to these vigilantes who think who want to be police folks, mm-hmm. and you don't arrest and prosecute and convict these folks in the same manner in which you do black folks. I could never sit with my knee on my former coworker's neck until they stop breathing and not be arrested. That would never happen. None of these gentlemen could do it. Dr. Davis, Dr. Hobson, you could never do that. Sit on Grace's till she expires and then you just get to go home. That does not happen. That does not happen. And so, yeah, you know, she's frustrated. And so, like, no, I don't want people to burn stuff down. I don't want people to destroy things. But I understand why people do it. And I understand what she's saying. And look what happens when you do it. Nah, we get a police officer arrested and charged. Right. The other three, we don't know what's going to happen to. But things start moving, things start happening. People start moving with some deliberate speed and doing what they should have done beforehand.
Professor Davis, your reaction to what Eva had to say?
It is thoroughly understood. We have a failure. First of all, let's back up. Part of our response is going to be your political, social political platform. And that is, do you believe that larger society has an obligation or a more conservative view that the individual must stand on her own and provide for herself and acquire the resources needed to mitigate these types of forces alone? I am on the former side, and that is, I think that there is a responsibility. And I say that to lead to the notion we have no mitigating structures to undermine the absence of knowledge. So that pure ignorance of what else is there, which we know to be a false, you know, dichotomy. These aren't the only two choices, but when you're not afforded people the opportunity to see other possibilities, to hear other possibilities, which leads to a critique of our education system. We're anti-intellectual in this regard. So Brother Hobson has already pointed out there's an ignorance with respect to historical context and historical method and how you're going to understand yourself in light of context. But then you have the added feature. How is it that we believe that you can change the hearts and minds of a people when you have parochially focused on STEM? And I'm going to take it there, because the problem is we want to, I would say, intentionally cultivate engineers and scientists and think that you become a humane human being by breathing air. That's intentional. We have to work on ourselves. So part of it has to be, what type of investment will we make on humane letters? How are we going to understand who we are? History, philosophy, religion, literature. These are the things that animate who we are as animals, but a different sort of animal. And you see the sort of diminution of these folk, of these areas in academic and social environments. No longer do we turn to experts. Anybody with a microphone can give an opinion, no foundations. I say all this circuitously to our point. This sister standing out there, guess what? What else is there, right? And the thing is, all three of us professors could tell her, listen, sister, they're good. They got insurance. So you're not hurting them, but I understand if you were to burn my house down, that might create some consternation on my part. But to burn down anything in Phipps Plaza, they're good. They are fine. They already been overcharging anyway, so they have enough profit to cover it, even if they didn't have insurance. So they're fine. But more importantly, the difficulty is trying to get our brothers and sisters to understand, I know you're inclined to think that you're undermining their economic integrity, but you're not, right? So how do we enforce this? Our educational structures must be clear and coherent and well-structured such that these students understand how basic economics work, how social forces infringe upon our humanity in ways that we oftentimes stifle in our understanding of our commitment to others, et cetera. And so this sister stands there and says what I've heard students and others say for a long time. You won't listen to me, I'll burn it down. I know why you believe that. But guess what? At the end of the day, they're just going to get more funding. I mean, think about in 08, quickly in 08, everybody thought, well, the market has turned. Every corporation came back hotter than they ever had. Insurance companies were given powers that we never imagined. You deregulated, you kept giving them loans, you kept, these industries are covered. It's the individual citizens. And I don't know anything about Main Street. I'll just say Stewart Avenue, because Main Street ain't where I grew up. The idea that you're going to cover people who are impoverished, who've been undermined by the development of a city, my beloved Atlanta, but you undermine the integrity of areas and people who've been needing you for a long time. So now she's people who come here and finally find out that all that glitters is not just not gold, it's not even silver. And you're stuck now because your assumption was, I thought it was better. No, we're in the U.S. It's the same animal, you know, different day, different time, but same animal. So this sister, I would love to tell her if I could. I'm saying, listen, I understand the animus that you have against this structure, but the best thing we can do is try to somehow develop, because everybody, all what the political scientists say, all politics is local. So you start with your home, start with your community, you build out from there, because that's the type of change we need. We obviously know nobody's coming to our rescue. There is no more super Negro. No, not going to happen. Never was, but it becomes more apparent because people are still waiting. Who's going to speak next? And I've seen this on CNN. Who's going to speak up? You speak up. I did an interview with this non-Black sister the other day, and she asked a question about, well, what are you all going to do? It's not our responsibility. You've infringed upon my right to think clearly, right? You undermine my growth socially, politically, economically. So as Malcolm said, his second go around, don't ask me what you can do. No, go and talk to other people like yourself. You all have these meetings and talk to each other. Why do we feel this way? Why do we treat these people this way? And maybe you're gonna have to have a class distinction as well, because I do believe there's some white brothers and sisters who care. The difficulty is getting that 1% to somehow engage and care enough, because that's the problem, right? The 1% isn't just the individual, it's corporations as well. Right? And we keep losing that. So we oftentimes mention the name of the CEOs and the founders, name the companies. And I won't do that on your show to protect, you know, but there are named companies here in Atlanta that have not done right by these communities. And they have the financial wherewithal to help develop these communities.
Well, Professor Davis, as you know, on this program, the whole purpose is it's a platform for constructive dialogue. So that's up to you. But before we go to break, Professor Hobson, I do want you to, as we go to break, I do want you to comment on Eva, mother of three boys.
So I understand Eva's frustration and even rage because she's thinking about a system that has hurt, is harmed, it's maimed, it's done so for the entire experience of Black, Brown, women, marginalized communities all together. So I understand it. But if I'm correct, Eva was the woman who moved here 6 years ago, mm-hmm. correct?
From Cincinnati.
From Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And Ilya, Professor Davis is an Atlanta native. And to Professor Davis, he could hear burn down my city that I love, the community that I love, even Stewart Avenue, you know, Main Street, Simpson Road, whatever. But that's what can be heard. And you can already see that, the polemic nature of that. But I'm reminded of this. I cut my teeth on doing Atlanta history because I am the biggest Outkast and Goody Mob fan in the world. That's really what turned me on to Atlanta in the ways. And in the song Get Up, Get Out on Outkast's first album, Andre Benjamin, known as Andre 3000 in his later years, states, they tell me that I need to get out and vote, huh? Why? Ain't nobody Black running but white folks. So why I gotta register? I'm thinking of better stuff to do with my time. What we have to know and understand is that there is a segment of this population that just do not believe in American democracy because American democracy has failed them. Is any good warrior, most warriors, the trait of a really good warrior is that they seek peace at all costs, because if it goes across the line, they hold nothing back. And I'm saying that to say you must have intellect, you must have strategy. You can't just jump out.
And when we come back, our conversation will continue. All this week, our conversations are dedicated to this past weekend's protests, the aftermath, and what's next, Atlanta. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
As we return to our conversation this week, we'll have conversations about 21st century protesting. Where is Atlanta's next wave of leadership? Where should it come from? We'll talk about voting, and we'll talk about race reconciliation. Of those topics, Professor Burton, through your lens, and again, 21st century protesting, Atlanta's next wave of leadership, voting, and race reconciliation. What is crucial in when we talk about what's next for Atlanta and actionable outcomes based on the outrage that transpired over the weekend?
I think that Atlanta will rebound, obviously. I think Atlanta has great academics, as you can see here on your show, that are also committed to and part of the community. I think that's something that, especially your Black academics, most Black academics I know are members of Black organizations. They work closely with the NAACP, Urban League, and things of that nature. Those traditional, what we call traditional civil rights organizations, as well as work with some of the newer and the younger organizations, some of the tech organizations, if you will. But I think that we have to figure out how we get Atlanta to be, let me rephrase that, how we get Georgia, the state of Georgia, which is really, to me, the black eye that of a state and its leadership, to shift so that Atlanta stands a better chance of surviving this onslaught of white supremacy that never went away, but it's just hyper visible right now, you know, with that person we have in the White House. So I think that it's going to start with voting. You know, I think that Stacey Abrams, Fair Fight Georgia, if you need a place to put your money or your time, we need to be looking at that. Voter suppression is real here. We've got to be looking at the mishandling. You know, that's what Dr. Dobson said at the beginning, at the top of the show, of this pandemic, and really getting some leadership in place that is going to speak to the needs of Black people throughout the state, not just here in Atlanta with our wonderful schools and civic organizations and all that thing that we have going on here, but throughout the state of Georgia. I think the leadership is going to come from the young people. It always comes from the young people. that are training now, that are out in the protest and have the right heart and the right minds and have the information behind them. And I think a lot of the leadership is going to come out of the tech community, honestly. I'm not saying that we don't have, you know, I believe in humanistic inquiry. You know, I'm a professor of film and media.
Why the tech industry? That's very interesting.
Because the tech industry, in my mind, is where you get the most movement. You're able to reach the largest number of people. And so many young people live in that space. Like for us, you know, people in our age group, you know, we do it all. We get to pay. We still subscribe to the paper. We still watch television. We, you know, we're on our phones. That's why I was like, oh, yeah, I got to cut this off. You know, we're doing all of these things. But young people live exclusively in the tech world. Many of them do. And so I think that they have very interesting ways of connecting people, very interesting ways of organizing folks. If we can get away from this misinformation, you know, that Mark Zuckerberg is committed to supporting, while you have the gentleman over at Twitter who's like, ah, we got to start doing something because this is getting out of hand. So you're going to see that that war is the next war, right? The battle over information. If we win that, then I think that you can use technology and activism together in order to create the change that these young folks need to see and be a part of as we go forward. While we do what we've been doing and hopefully do it better.
Professor Davis, moving forward, and it may be a topic that I haven't listed, but 21st century protesting, Atlanta's next wave of leadership, voting, race reconciliation. Where does Atlanta begin?
Well, I will refer back to good brother Du Bois. The fundamental problems here of color, hair and bone, as Du Bois likes to say in his Conservation of Races, is still a problem in Atlanta, and it can't be fixed even if we were to stop what's transpiring downtown right now. It just doesn't go away. And we've had the tendency to assume that out of sight, out of mind, changes the social, economic, and racial conditions, and it does not. And so I am again arguing for a return, if I could even say that, to humanistic studies. We have to intentionally work on being better human beings. It can't be by accident. So whatever change we develop, because I don't have a panacea and some, you know, wand to wave the healing of America. But I know that it begins with studying what does it mean to intentionally develop a more humane and more disciplined caring structure, right? We have to care about caring. Mm-hmm. It can't be an accident. We must care about caring. Like I always tell my students, I know what you're willing to do based on what you tell me you care about. And we don't care about race. We don't care about bridging the economic gap. You know, there have been reports that Atlanta is one of the worst in the country, if not the worst, in our economic divide. We can't intellectually, socially, economically move forward unless we change the lessons. I mean, moving forward in time is simple. We can't control that, right? We're going to keep moving in time, depending on your philosophy of time. But the point has to do, when we say, what do we do moving forward? The assumption is certain types of direct action will be employed to help change the minds and the hearts of people. That's what we really mean. So what is it going to take to change our views of one another? How do we then incorporate this into the larger social system? That's the difficulty. And I'm making an argument, we must do better in our educational structures, right? We have to inform people early. We're not indoctrinating, we're trying to, again, back to the Sister Eva earlier, we're trying to give more possibility, more alternatives. So whatever decision you make is not parochial based on I only had choices A through D versus all the rest of the alphabet that I should have been choosing from. Mm-hmm. And so as we move forward, I think one thing is going to have to change, and all of us are representative. The so-called old and new must work together. We've had this antagonism for years. I don't listen to old people don't listen to young people. We really need to work together. Back to Hobson's point, the issue is you can't have historical context unless you have somebody who knows not just through, you know, formal education, but existentially. Sit down and talk to somebody. And then on the other side, I must be able to sit down with somebody young and get some sense of how the world is structured for them. Because again, we have bequeathed that world to them, and how they reinterpret it comes out in ways that we oftentimes push against, right? So we give it to them, they interpret it, give it back to us, and we argue about it, right? Selfishness, self-centeredness, this notion of invulnerability, which leads them to walk around the streets, as you said earlier, without masks. Because what? I'm fine. What about everybody? I'm good, right? And so my point is we have to interact with one another in more dynamic ways and not assume that one answer or one approach is going to solve it. We are in a complex mixture and it needs as many resources as possible.
Professor Hobson, I'll give you the last word in terms of moving forward when we talk about what next for Atlanta. How do you see it?
So when you frame the question, I mean, there's so many things going through my mind, but I'm going to make this succinct. Oftentimes when you talk about local politics and particularly progression, the Honorable Mayor Maynard Jackson's name is brought forth. And Maynard Jackson was a special kind of statesman in terms of his vision. I mean, he saw new and innovative ways of governing. And one of the things that there were four things or five things that Maynard Jackson did that made him beloved within the Black community. And there were some things that he did that made him questionable, but there were five things that he did. The first was his affirmative action, of course, you know, expanding MARTA and building the airport, but the creation of the neighborhood planning units that really included citizens, and also the way in which he framed how if police brutality took place in the city, how he would have a special hand in making sure that that officer was prosecuted, meaning that the problem with police brutality is that it violates the 14th Amendment, which grants equal protection and due process under the law. You're supposed to have an opportunity to go and have your day in court, but if you're the judge and jury and you kill and maim right there, you don't have that. We need leadership that is willing to step out there in a very clear kind of way and say any kind of police involved incident needs to be investigated, and it could be on a community level. It would be great to see an American president that signs an executive order. We need very strict laws because the police have power. I mean, when I was growing up, it was often said that the police were the biggest gang on the street. But what I've done to try to commit myself is I am a critical professor. I believe in critical knowledge, which will produce critical citizens. Sometimes I'll take the other stance with my students to get them to think on the other side. And what I've done is I teach a course every fall, the history of African Americans in Georgia. And that course has become a think tank for my students who go out, do Gallup polls, who do all of the fundamental research to identify the issues that are really hurting Black communities. And then they do full reports, and I offer the students' reports as a think tank to the state legislature. I'll offer that to the city. What I'm trying to do is to create the next group of leaders, but I want them to be leaders. And you know, the thing about leadership is it's not easy, and you must be prepared you must be prepared for resistance. I am an old football player. And one of the things I always know is when you step out on the field, there are 11 people trying to stop what you're trying to do. So that's a part of the game. And so with this being said, how I want to move forward in terms of racial reconciliation, in terms of protest, is I use my platform as a professor in the public to really foster these kinds of conversations, to allow for better political literacy, to allow for us to know and understand how the system works. And if we understand how the system works, then we can really find the loopholes and work things in our favor. The old people where I'm from will say, in order to bend the rules, you first must know the rules.
From Georgia State University, Maurice Hobson, Associate Professor in African American Studies and the author of The Legend of the Black Mecca, Politics and Class and the Making of Modern Atlanta. And Singer Burton, Professor and Multimedia Journalist, who's also the Co-Director of Film and Media Management at Emory University. Ilya Davis, Director, New Students and Transition Programs, and Professor of Philosophy at Morehouse College. Thank you all for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Professor Hobson, did you just call all of us old?
Well, listen.
Are we part of that generation now where they don't listen to us?
Listen, getting old is a privilege.
I appreciate you all for taking the time for kickstarting this week's series of conversations. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sister Rose.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.